Welcome to the OnFit Podcast.
I'm Ellie Groves from OnFit, and this podcast will discuss euro area financial stability. There is much to cover, and in this 20 or so minutes, we will focus on broad economic position of the euro area, implications from the US fiscal stimulus on the financial stability in the euro area, and how businesses can recover as government support normalises in the post-recovery phase. I'm very pleased to welcome our speaker, Pedro Duarte Neves, who acted as alternate chairperson for the EBA from July 2013 to June 2018. Over the past years, he's also chaired a number of committees in the scope of the FSB, EBA, and the joint committees of the ESA. He is very closely aligned to Banco de Portugal and joined the research department in 1994. He has been there until 2004 and is still aligned with the central bank. Pietro is a visiting professor at Lisbon School of Business and Economics and has published many articles in scientific journals. So we're very pleased to have you, Pietro. Thank you for joining us. I'm going to start with my initial question, which is just to give a brief overview of the current state of play and the fiscal stability in the euro area and any great risks that you see. So where we are now and what do you think as we come out of the kind of the COVID health crisis, what are the key economic risks that you see for the euro area?
Hi, Ellie. Great to be here. Thanks a lot to you and Onfi for this invitation. It's really a pleasure to be here. So on your first question, I mean, up to now, there was a very good response of economic agents and the financial sector. Policy, I mean, all the policies, fiscal, monetary, prudential policy, all of them have been very effective and extremely successful up to now. We managed to have the increase in unemployment contained, the same with corporate insolvencies and financial stress, and the banking sector up to now performed very well. The most recent economic forecasts, and all of them, IMF, OECD, World Bank, they suggest a stronger recovery than previously expected, particularly so in high-income countries. And just yesterday, ECB released the forecast for the euro area, which also revised upwards by sort of an alpha percentage point in both 2021 and 2022. On the financial sector, financial stocks have been performed favorably in the recent past. The signs of declining financial integration have been overcome, and the indicators used by ECB have returned to the levels prior to the crisis. As I said, the financial sector has reacted very well up to now, and the banking sector, as it was well capitalized at the beginning of the current crisis, has been performing very well. Now, on the concerns, and of course there are key risks in front of us. What is going to happen this year and next year? From the economic point of view, I would say that the two key aspects are the scaring effect, how strong will be the impact on potential output of the crisis. But here we have to now have good news and good projections. And second, the risk of asymmetries, which are not risk, actually, they are more almost taken as granted, asymmetries in the recovery across countries, across sectors, and within sectors. On the financial stability side, in particular, and drawing on some of the reflections of the last financial stability review of ECB, I would highlight the impact on non-performing loans and the surge in insolvencies, how sizable they will be and what will be the impact on the banking sector. Second, legacy of higher debt and weaker balance sheets resulting from this recession. Developments in non-banking sector as well. There were registered further increasing credit, liquidity and duration risks. Fourth, the risks of asset repricing risks related to the recent rise of long-term interest rates. And finally, but extremely important, the issue of low profitability of the EU banking sector. So in general, my opinion is the following. So far, so good, but the resilience of financial sector still remains to be tested and challenged over the next 18 months or so.
Thank you. I think that that's an excellent summary. I want to pick a little bit more detail on some of those risks that you identified. The first one being that the fact that some economies and countries and sectors were hit harder than the others, and you saw that asymmetry, as you mentioned, and that not only were they hit the most when the lockdown initially happened in 2020, but also were the slowest to find that resurgence and resilience coming back. And then obviously we've had various other cycles of lockdowns. And does the sectoral divergence impact financial stability? And how do you see that play out in the long run, potentially between both sectors? And also, if you're comfortable, to also touch on the different countries, potentially recovery phases and plans, and how can the euro area economies best adapt to this changing landscape to ensure a sustainable economic recovery?
Yeah, thanks, Ellie. That's really a very good question. Is the key question, which has to do basically with the size of the legacy of the COVID-19 crisis. And by that, I mean how many insolvencies, how many NPLs, how much over-indebtedness emerged from this crisis. And this really poses a very important question, which is the most important today, which is the identification of viable firms. So in terms of policy action, the really important point is the balance between too much insolvencies, which are extremely costly if they occur in viable firms. And this is what I call the type one error, allow a viable firm to fail. And the balance between too much insolvency, I would say, and too much zombification, which is the risk of supporting unviable firms. And that's what I call the type two error. And both of them have costs. Allowing viable firms to fail implies loss of firm-specific know-how, costs of insolvency and their spillovers, loss in stock of capital, costs in unemployment. The risk of supporting unviable firms, which is particularly present given the very low interest rate environment. So the risk of supporting unviable firms leads to insufficient capital allocation, has a negative effect on productivity, leads to an insufficient allocation of resources in the economy and reduces productive growth. So the real challenge in the short term is to find the right balance between too much and too little support. And for that, it's important to be aware that this crisis is different than the great financial crisis, because SMEs are particularly affected and are particularly well represented in hard hit sectors. For instance, the IMF poses 1 in 10 jobs in SMEs, in SMEs at the risk. And NPLs as a result will also be different. NPLs will likely be concentrated among SMEs, heterogeneous and possible without much valuable collateral. So the really question is, how big will be the impact in NPLs and therefore in the banking sector? Concerning the policy action, my suggestions will be the following. Fiscal policy and monetary policy should continue to support the recovery. Of course, the need for a right balance between too much and too little support. Promote flexible and fast allocation of economic resources within economic sectors. Use macroprudential policy, and in particular target macroprudential tools to address rising non-financial sector vulnerabilities, and then some adjustments on the macroprudential policy framework, but for sure we'll have more time to address that. Concerning regional discrepancies, the message is very clear. High-income economies are recovering much stronger than the rest of the world, and that reflects the much stronger policy support that took place. So at this stage, it's really clear that there will be an asymmetric in the world recovery.
Thank you. I want to touch on the Next Generation EU Fund and potentially the favourable financing conditions that we currently see that are seeing, that's helping to mitigate the short-term risks of the fiscal budget. So you're seeing the kind of the PEP programme, Next Generation EU Fund. There's been a lot of European focus in ensuring favourable financial conditions, but also ensuring that there is investment into the recovery. What do you see the long-term risks of this? And please do also touch on that issue of sovereign debt. And how do you see, what are the long-term risks of this recovery phase that Europe has really kind of stepped up in many ways, but where can you see that might play out as an issue? Or do you think that actually that those risks are potentially overhyped? I guess it gets down to the question on, do we think that the inflationary changes, or do we see inflation rises as structural or cyclical? Which argument do you come down on the side of?
Well, starting by the next generation EU package, that is really a game changer. It will complement national fiscal support, and it will be a key tool to make the recover, stronger and faster. And on top of that, the EC's, the European Commission's Common Debt Insurance, will for sure boost the international role of the euro. So I see that really as a game changer. Turning to the fiscal and the sovereign, as you mentioned, and once again, taking note of ECB projections that were released yesterday, public debt is likely to be at around the slightly less than 100% at the end of this year. And then, but of course, it has been very much affected by the denominator effect. And then project to decline to 95% 2 years ahead. In spite of the increase in the debt over GDP ratio, it's very important to have in mind that lower interest rates on one side and longer maturities on the other side, those two effects have partially offset the adverse impact of higher levels of debt on the debt service ratio. Of course, there are some risks in the medium term, which I would say that exist but are contained, which basically correspond to the following. The possible need to extend the existing support measures. The risk of materialization of contingent liabilities. On one side, the public guarantee schemes that were introduced last year, and in some cases, possible payouts for state-owned enterprises. Third, and that, of course, is very important, the sudden rise in interest rates, an abrupt rise in interest rates reflecting increasing risk premium, for instance, and then risks of debt overhang if GDP growth proves to be lower than the current projections. On inflation prospects, I don't see no really risks there in the sense that the projections 2 years ahead are around 1.5, 1.4%. So nothing really is coming there. The surge in inflation this year has been a temporary phenomenon driven by one-off effects like the increase in oil prices, and it is predicted to fade next year. But that, of course, in the euro area, on the United States, is possibly a different story.
Yeah, and actually I want to move on to the United States. So the next kind of thing I want to explore and the question is that the large fiscal, accommodative fiscal stance of the US, which has led to possible spillovers of up to 0.3% of real GDP for the euro area, could also see a divergence between the two economic areas. So even though there could be some positivity for the euro area out of the large fiscal stance of the US, if the two countries do diverge very differently, what is the potential effects you could see having on financial stability in the euro area if there is this large divergence that is built out during the recovery?
Well, Ellie, I mean, as we have been seeing in, over the past years, recoveries in the US tend to be quicker and stronger than recoveries in Europe. And that will be the case. Just taking 2020 and 2021, GDP growth in the US will be higher than the one for the euro area of accumulated 5 percentage points, 3 percentage points last year, 2 percentage points in 2021. The US economy has already recovered pre-COVID-19 GDP levels, whereas in Europe that will happen by the end of next year. And when turning to output losses associated with the recession, they are basically projected to not exist in the US, whereas they will be reducing the euro areas, something like minus 0.5%. Behind that, I mean, this much stronger fiscal response in the US is of course, a decisive contributor for that. But it's important to have in mind that the projected fiscal deficit for the US in 2022 will be still 10%, and that in 2019, just before the crisis, where the U.S. economy was operating at full potential, the deficit was already at 7%, and public debt by the end of next year in the U.S. is likely to be something like 150% of GDP, so 35 percentage points above 2019. Of course, this very strong and unique fiscal response in the US brings some risks. One of them has to do with the current debate on inflation prospects in the US. Mm-hmm. If there are effects on inflation and inflation expectations. And just yesterday again, there was released a CPI of 5% in the US and a core CPI of plus 3.8%. It's not, of course, there are very temporary effects playing a role here, but the debate on the future evolution of monetary policy in the US will for sure dominate the economic debate over the next quarters, for sure. Risks for the financial stability in the euro area from there. Basically, I see the following. Risks of spillover of higher yield in the US to the euro area, and that has already happened, but in a much more reduced scale than what happened in the States. I mean, since the raise of the US 10-year yields, in advanced economies, long-term yields increased by 50 basis points. And that, of course, will bring risks to debt sustainability, particularly in the corporate sector. I mean, if it goes much more than what we observe, of course. And there is also the risk of spillovers from equity markets that could affect equity markets in the euro area as well. And there is a third channel of possible effects through effects on emerging countries, which are much more sensitive to interest rates in the US. And just to conclude here, I think it's important to highlight the very strong increase in global debt. And in global debt, I include, as the Institute for International Finance does, households, non-financial corporates and governments. The debt in, I mean, last year was 215 trillions. Whereas 2007, before the JFC, it was 100 trillion. So the real issue here is the risk associated with the this huge amount of global debt that, I mean, exists basically everywhere. And of course, all of that will be put at risk if there is an abrupt repricing of risk premium, for instance.
I wanted to just pick up slightly on your thoughts regarding that strong rise in US yields in comparison to the euro area yields and their effect on global capital flows. How do you see that playing out?
To bring some figures, I mean, the reason for the increase in US long-term nominal interest rates has been the improved economic forecasts. And since the summer last year, the increase has been around 1 percentage point, 125 basis points. They have been in the range of 1.5, 1.75. Today they are 1.44. Investors expect long-term interest rates in the US to return to pre-pandemic levels. So in the range of 1.75 to 1%. And there are some important aspects here as well. First, the increase in the real component of those long-term yields. And second, on the, I mean, very sizable increase in the slope of yield curves. How could this spill over to the euro area? I mean, of course, one of spillovers is through long-term yields in Europe, and therefore, as a result on the yields on corporate debt, for instance. But there is also a second channel, which is in the case, which I would say it is not the most likely at this stage, which is if US Treasury yields increase further on expectations of monetary policy tightening without too strong real growth, which I say again is not the most likely case, then US equity prices could decline significantly. And the ECB has a rule of thumb, which is the following. A 10% correction in US equity prices that is associated with US monetary policy tightening might lead to a fall in euro area equity prices of around the same size. So that's a second channel from equity markets. I mean, on the impact on global capital flows, I would say that's a bit too early to have strong views on this. I mean, strong rise in US yields compared with the euro area yields could generate, I mean, in theory, and as a result, shifting investor and capital flows, and could eventually induce a reduction in international demand for euro area sovereign bonds. But, I mean, that's too early to have final views on this.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I'm going to ask a final question that sort of wraps up both what support governments can give to businesses throughout this recovery phase, while the support that they've given is steadily withdrawn. So there needs to be structural policy changes to ensure that we don't, to minimize the rate of insolvency for these businesses. And also, what is the key lesson that you've learned from this crisis? So where do you think we should be when we see a next crisis? So what needs to happen now to also build in resilience from this crisis, but also to change some structures to ensure resilience for a future crisis?
Yeah, great. So I will speak first on say, more economic policy action, and then I will draw some lessons from the point of view of financial stability and macroprudential. So I try to divide your question in just two. So on policy, I mean, fiscal policy support should be well targeted and calibrated to the evolution of the pandemic as it has been up to now. There should be an improvement in the efficiency of insolvency procedures. There is room for that at the EU level. And that is crucial for speedy and effective recoveries. It's important to address structural problems in the labor market, like the disadvantage that youngsters, long-term unemployment, and somewhat less educated have. Recover from the negative impact of human capital associated with interruption of schooling. Take advantage of teleworking, which can potentially bring productivity gains in the medium term, and also to promote a rigorous competition policy enforcement. And for the euro area in particular, it's very important to complete the banking union, to have a EU-wide DGS, and to foster development of the capital market union in the euro area. Now, turning to macroprudential policy learning lessons and for the preservation of financial stability in general, I will say the following. Possibly it will be wise to increase what is called the macroprudential space in banking, in the sense that countercyclical macroprudential buffers could be strengthened without raising the total level of regulatory capital requirements, so allowing for a more significant adjustment in crises like this one without requiring intervention in other capital buffers. Second, and that is extremely important, the need to develop the macroprudential framework for non-banks, targeting excessive liquidity mismatch and excessive leverage, achieve closer alignment between funds redemption profiles and the underlying assets, and in general to identify tools to reduce excessive procyclicality. It's also third suggestion and drawing on the work of the IAS and EIOPA and also the ESRB, to develop the macroprudential framework for insurers and pension funds. That is, I think, an important lesson of this crisis. The need to address the insurance protection gaps that exist today, pension gap, the national catastrophe gap, the cybersecurity gap, the non-damage business interruption gap, and that will require a very strong and aligned effort by authorities. And in what concerns the climate change, it's very important, and I draw your attention to the recent NGFS report, the need to overcome decisively the existing data gaps, which requires a common and consistent set of global disclosure standards, as well as an accepted global taxonomy and development of transparent and defined according to international standards of metrics, certification levels, and methodological standards. And just a very final mention to the need for the European space to implement the Basel III in a timely and consistent with international standards way. It's really very important that Basel III is implemented timely and in a consistent way with the international agreed standards.
Thank you so much. I think we've covered a lot of ground in quite a short amount of time, so thank you very much for that. Even given the economic crisis due to the fiscal and monetary policy measures that were and policies that were taken immediately in 2020 and the support that has been given to business and the economy, we are in a relatively good place, all things considered, but there are a lot of risks and there needs to be frameworks put in place to ensure that the resilience continues and that as we go back to path towards normalization, the climate agenda is taken seriously, a banking union is established, and the focus on insolvency is tightened and unified a little further within the euro area. Is that sort of a fair enough summary, very briefly, of the key points that we were looking to cover?
Yeah, that's a great summary, Ellie.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to having further conversations with you. These are issues that I'm sure will not go away. We are hoping more and more for the banking union to conversations to come to fruition. We've also got discussions on the CMU, Capital Markets Union, which we didn't speak about. But so there is much more to cover in this space. So thank you for joining us. Thank you all for listening. And please do sign up to our podcast channel. Thank you very much.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the OnFIF podcast.